Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do as a divorce mediator and document preparation company. I specialize in amicable divorces. We have part two of one of the most fascinating interviews I've done with Dr. Talal Al-Saleem. Welcome back, Talal.
Thanks for having me back, Judy.
You wrote an amazing book. The name of the book is Infidelity, the topic of this program, of this episode. Infidelity, the best, worst thing that could happen to your marriage. And I love the fact that you have an exploding heart on the cover of your book. A picture tells 1,000 words, right? This is the complete guide on how to heal from affairs. And Talal is an infidelity recovery specialist. So we covered a lot in part one. We laid the groundwork for how to identify infidelity, how to categorize it, and what are the causes of it. So on this episode, we're going to talk about why closure, the right type of closure, is important, and why understanding why the infidelity happened, why that's important to carry on, either to stay together or to separate. So let's pick up on this. Why is it important to have the right kind of closure?
Well, I always give the example, and I don't know if some of your audiences were old enough to remember the Kelly Book Blue Value for a car when your car gets in an accident, and how do you determine how much your car is worth, right?
We use it in divorce to evaluate vehicle assets, yes.
Okay, perfect. So I feel kind of like, when you have something as devastating as infidelity that happened to you in your relationship, it is really important to assess the damage, right? To see if this can be repaired or not. And you cannot do that without being able to disclose as well as get closure, right? Because it allows you to understand what happened and why it happened so that you can make an informed decision about it. And to me, really, it's the piece of, and this is especially important for the folks who decide to rebuild their relationship after infidelity. If they don't have that true understanding, they're going to struggle in having a happy, fulfilling relationship because then the damage is so devastating. You cannot just navigate the future without understanding the one and the why. But even if they don't decide to stay together and move on to other relationships, for those who are fortunate enough to sever ties and not have to have mutual assets or co-parents, they might also struggle in carrying these trauma with them in future relationships. So if the unfaithful doesn't understand what happened and why it happened, there is a big chance that pattern might repeat itself in future relationship. The betrayed might struggle with starting a new relationship with not trusting anybody, right? Because they've been betrayed from before. And also if there was a relationship factors that led to the infidelity, that's going to get swept under the rug. But even for the couples who decide to separate and they still have to be in each other's life because of co-parenting, how can they co-parent effectively because they still have some kind of partnership if they don't really understand what happened, why it happened, and own up to the part that they both played to ending the relationship? And again, that doesn't minimize the responsibility of the unfaithful. As I said in the last episode, the unfaithful is 100% responsible for acting on whatever dysfunction, whether it was relationship, individual, or sociocultural, that's related to infidelity. But it is important for everybody to own up to the part that they played to leading to that point. Not the infidelity piece, but to set the stage to the infidelity.
So to stay or not to stay, that is the question. How do you determine that?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. So this would be a good segue to talk about the milestones first, right? So first, I guess, let me start with this. In order for couples to heal from infidelity, they have to go through a very specific milestone to help them to figure out what is the best path for them, which would be a good point for me to highlight what is infidelity counseling and what is the purpose of it? So infidelity counseling is a subfield of couples counseling that my work through systematic affair recovery therapy, the model that I developed, is kind of pioneering this subfield. And the purpose of infidelity counseling, the way I see it, is not necessarily to repair the relationship. It's really to help the clients understand what happened, why it happened, assess the damage, and choose the appropriate path of healing for the two of them. So the purpose of infidelity counseling is not necessarily to repair the relationship that can be a potential outcome. The main purpose of infidelity counseling is to process the trauma of the affair and heal from it and make sure it doesn't define the rest of your client's life. Right?
Right.
So this leads to, how do couples navigate this? So just kind of to give a background of why systematic affair recovery therapy was developed, which set the stage of outlining the steps. When I was a younger clinician, I promised myself that I want to give myself a well-rounded clinical experiences because I wanted to learn about myself as a person, as a clinician, weaknesses and strength. So I got the opportunity to work with almost any level of care that you can think of, inpatient, outpatient, anything in between, with all different client populations. And because every place that you work for, they have different populations, so they end up to training on their own modality of treatments to help serve their client population. So at the end of that journey, I accumulated a lot of clinical tools through all these different certification training that I have taken. But also I realized that the client's population that I'm passionate about is couples. And when I began to set my private practice, I began to realize that a lot of the couples, they don't come to couples counseling because they need a tune-up. There are some who do, but most of them, they're coming to couples counseling because they're in crisis. And a big portion of those are in crisis because they're dealing with infidelity. When I looked at all this extensive toolbox that I have, none of the tools that I have were tailored designed for infidelity, right? And it was, to me, it was mind-boggling. It's like, wow, so we have such a prevalent, devastating issue, but we don't really have a tailor-made tool to help couples navigate this process. So as they say, need is the mother of invention. So I started jotting down my observation because all my clients were couples and majority of them are couples dealing in crisis because of infidelity. I began to see very universal theme that all my clients have shared in their struggles of recovering in infidelity. And this was the case with the clients I worked with who came from different backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, different age groups, different type of relationships. They all seem to be struggling on very specific steps. And those universal struggles kind of set the stage of the milestones that developed the systematic affair recovery therapy model that outlines the steps that couples need to go through in order for them to make an informed decision about how to heal. I know that was a long story, but I wanted to give you kind of the foundation behind it. So bring it back to, you know, briefly to describe the milestones in terms of what couples go through. So there are 7 milestones in the clinical process. The first one is setting the stage for healing. And this is really important to focus on the clinical objective in that stage is to make sure that the clients have the optimal environment for recovery. Right after the discovery of an affair, people make a lot of mistakes, and those mistakes could potentially change the potential outcome that they can have when it comes to making a decision about repairing their relationship. So it is important, right after discovery, infidelity is for people to seek help right away to make sure that they're working with somebody to help them have the right environment that will help them make the right decision without causing any complication. So a common mistake people make if they didn't have this stage is that they reach out to the third party, right? After the discovery of the affair, you feel like that oftentimes the betrayed want to reach out to the third party and want to reach out to the third party and the third party's husband or wife because I shouldn't be the only one who's suffering. They need to know, right?
Oh, you're absolutely right. I didn't think about that. Yes.
Why they want to reach out to the third parties, and it's not just only sometimes that their partner needs to know, but also sometimes I want to know what happened. I can't trust my unfaithful partner who is deceptive, and I need you to tell me the story, right? Now, this can be problematic if you don't intervene early on and tell the betrayed that they shouldn't do this. I've seen this in a situation where the third party exaggerated the story, right? And told all these lies that did not happen. And I've seen sometimes where they minimize what happened and told a completely different innocent version of what the story is. And that could impede the whole process, because if you have other individuals with their own agendas and motives, they can give you a different narrative of the affair, which means that whatever decision that you make about the future of your relationship is not going to be the right decision because it's based on, you know, questionable information. So that's just one of the many things that happens in that stage, is to help the clients kind of agree on some of the logistic that will make sure it minimizes problems for them. Another common mistake people make is that they involve their kids in the exposure to the infidelity. That's problematic on many ways. So when research shows and clinical work shows is that when kids are exposed to parental infidelity, they have short-term and long-term impact. The short-term impact, it affects what alliances that they have. Somebody's going to side with the unfaithful. Somebody's going to sign with the betrayed. Sometimes they get triangulated and they become the messenger between the two. Sometimes they get used as a pawn. And I'm sure you see this in mediation too, right? In terms of twisting arms.
Well, right. Because in the overall marital settlement agreements, there's actually a family code that we have to write in there to say you're not going to use your children as messengers. And the easy answer is it's not their divorce. It's not their marriage. It's not their relationship. Their relationship is a parental child relationship, very one-on-one. They have nothing to do with how their parents interact with one another, nor should they.
That is correct. And this is important to highlight, not only that if the offsprings are children, even adult offsprings also can be impacted by this. It's like I said, not only that it affects what alliances people have to which parents, but also it affects the sibling relationship to one another. Siblings sometimes usually fight to say, why are you siding with mom? Why are you siding with dad? Right? It causes all these problems. Long-term, it affects their view about what relationships are, because most people usually see their parents as the primary relationship figure, right? So oftentimes, so again, it depends on how it's handled. So it either could send the message that infidelity is okay, mom did it, dad did it. So therefore it becomes a cultural norm.
Or
becomes an issue of if I can't trust my parents to be faithful, how the heck am I supposed to trust a significant other in the future to be faithful for me? So they might enter relationships distressful of the people they bring into their life and set the stage for a dissatisfactory future relationship. So that's usually kind of the focus on that first milestone, setting the stage for healing, is to help couples kind of prevent making those mistakes and educate them.
Can I ask one question, please, about not talking to the third party? Is there any value in talking to the third party, if done the right way? Is there a right way and any satisfaction towards healing that can come from talking to the third party?
You know, I struggle with that too, because again, I don't like to think of absolutes, but unfortunately, I have not seen a healthy need driving that, nor a successful execution of that. Because other motives for people to reach a third party is because I want to tell you, leave my man, leave my woman alone. Okay. And I cannot imagine somebody to be able to do this without dealing with verbal assaults, physical assault, damage of property. Another complicated factor that people need to keep in mind. Remember, we said a lot of affairs happen in the workplace. Statistics says 36% of affair partners or third parties are usually having in the workplace. So when you reach out to that, it creates an HR nightmare. I've seen people's recovery get delayed because of that. I worked with a dentist and his wife. The dentist had an emotional sexual affair with his dental hygienist. And right after the discovery, he wanted to keep his wife happy. He wanted to say, fine, I will fire her right away, right? No question asked. You discovered the affair. And what happened is that she filed that wrongful termination suit, right? That prolonged, they had to go to court for 2 years, reliving the trauma of the affair in the most excruciating detail, text, pictures, right? And now you introduce all the stressor and got a settlement of $1 million after that. So that insult to injury. So that's why it's important. So it's like, you know, when you involve the third party or the third party significant other, it opens up the door for all of these things, because the only, I guess, healthy outcome if somehow you get something from the third party to say, I'm sorry, I did this. That's rare to happen, right? Because the third party, I'm sure they're justifying why they're doing what they're doing. And sometimes they're aware of your existence and sometimes they're not. But either way, they have their own life that they're worrying about.
I get it. Okay, what is the second milestone?
So the second milestone, this is the most important and most crucial part of the whole process. And this is where people usually get stuck, which is getting the story of the infidelity. This is understanding what happened and why it happened. Most people usually get stuck because they either don't do it or they do it poorly. And this is challenging for clinicians as well as for clients to do. The clinical objective is to get the true narrative of what happened and when it happened. The trick is to make sure that you're choosing the right level of disclosure, because not every detail is important, right? It's the details that are necessary to understand the what on the why versus creating unnecessary images. And this is challenging for the unfaithful, both the unfaithful and the betrayed. The unfaithful sometimes says, well, I want to say what happened or why it happened, but I'm worried that, you know, how are you going to use this information against me, right? If I hear all this stuff and we end up not working out, what's going to happen? Is you're going to use it in child custody, court proceedings, so on and so forth. So we have to make the agreement that, you know, the sole purpose of sharing the story is to help us make an informed decision about the future of the relationship. And I always tell my clients, I don't write letters, I don't write recommendation. If we go to share the story, it would be for the therapeutic clinical purpose. Another anxiety non-faithful have is, what if I share this information and, you know, I'm going to further traumatize the betrayed? And I always say, well, it's already too late, because, you know, your partner's already traumatized because they discovered the affair. You can continue to lie to them or do something worse, which is giving the truth by a dropper, right? That means that every week I reveal something new and prolong their misery. Or we can get it all out in a safe environment, and we know it's going to be unpleasant, and we know it's going to be uncomfortable, but we're going to agree that we're going to use this information and how we process all these emotions about it in a healthy way that will help us get unstuck and make a decision about the relationship. So part of the getting the story is, again, helping the unfaithful connect the dots, the thoughts, the feelings, and the motivation behind what they did, but also showcasing to the betrayed as well that the unfaithful is able and willing to take some of those difficult steps of facing the things that they have done. There is a power, a therapeutic value in seeing your unfaithful partner doing this, because it's going to be difficult for them to do that, because they don't have to tell you, they're taking a risk and they're being vulnerable, and they're being vulnerable during a difficult time. And showcasing this vulnerability is important, especially if you want to rebuild trust with this person. That's kind of just a cliff note version of what happens in the getting the story.
May I ask you a question about that? So when you have the couple in the office for the first time, do you want the whole story to come out at once? Is that with the first session, or how do you present the story? How do you regulate that?
Great question. So getting the story doesn't always happen in the first session, depending on the circumstances and how explosive the situation is. Before I take on clients, I always say, you know, you need to educate your clients about what this entails, because a lot of times people drop out of counseling, couples counseling, family counseling, because they don't really know what the process is and they have unrealistic expectation. If you tell them what the process is and they're prepared for it, they're more likely going to be able to stick to the process because it is clear to them. That the first session is really kind of talking about what is the purpose of infidelity counseling, educating them, making sure that we all have the same definition of infidelity, because if we don't even agree that what happened is infidelity, we cannot move any forward, right?
We never touched each other physically. We just were on the internet.
Perfect. Right? That is a common thing. So I guess we have to talk about definition right now, because I don't think we got a chance to define infidelity in our last episode.
Okay.
So before anything else, people come to counseling as what? Because they have an issue to deal with. We have to agree on what we're going to call this issue, because if it's infidelity and we're calling it, oh, it's not infidelity, I was just doing something stupid or I was just doing something inappropriate, then we just minimize the big problem, right? But if it's actually not infidelity and it's something else and we called it infidelity, then we just exaggerated a small problem. So how do we define infidelity? So researchers cannot agree on how to define infidelity. Clinicians cannot agree how to define infidelity. And the average person doesn't know how to, they're not agreeing on how to define infidelity. So this was the first puzzle that I had to solve in, as a clinician, to kind of say, well, where do we go from here? So here's how I define my infidelity. And I believe in the last episode I talked about what it, well, yeah. So this definition is based on what? On my belief that relationship should be just like any kind of business partnership. That means that there has to be a contract that outlines, you know, how many partners we have in this relationship. Is it one? Is it two? Is it three? Right? Is it 10? And what are the emotional and sexual needs that are expected to be fulfilled by the partners in this relationship? And to what extent those relations, those needs fulfillments are exclusive to the partners that we have in this relationship contract. So the moment any partner outsource those emotional and sexual needs to somebody else outside of the partners in this relationship contract, it becomes a breach of contract. So the breach of contract by itself becomes infidelity. And the beauty of this definition is what? Is that you can adapt it to all types of models of relationship. Because believe it or not, even people who are polyamorous or in open marriages, they deal with infidelity as well. But their infidelity looks different than the couples who are adhering to a traditional type of monogamous relationship.
Talal, I was never so shocked in a mediation that I did about a year or so ago with a couple who had a very young child, about 1 or 2 years old, and there wasn't a lot to divide with assets and debts, but we had to do the co-parenting plan. There was so much anger on the part of the husband. I sat there and watched him fume, and the wife sat there quietly, and I was trying to figure out what was going on until finally she said, well, we had an open marriage. What do you care? And he said, well, we had an open marriage when we were all going to be together, but you took off with one of the other men and I didn't know about it. There yep. you go, right?
Perfect, perfect example. Like I said, and that's the, you know, that to me, the key was is to create a definition of infidelity that you can adapt to all types of relationship. But also, I needed a definition that would put a buffer between my value system as the clinician and my clients. Meaning, the clients are looking to you as the therapist to say, so what do you think, therapist? Is this infidelity or not? And you cannot play Switzerland, right? You have to put a name to it. But when I put a name to it, if I'm calling it infidelity, it's not because this is Talal's value system or religious belief or whatever. I say, okay, what is your relationship contract? Assuming they actually have a clear contract, right? Based on your relationship contract and the exclusivity clause of it, does this fit or not? If it fits, great. I'm going to call it infidelity in the story, right? That is the best way to get everybody on board, which means that, you know, if it's... If liking somebody's bikini picture on Facebook is considered infidelity, if that's their relationship contract, then that's their relationship contract. If it's watching pornography, if it's intercourse with different partners, you can adapt it to whatever relationship contract that they have. Now, again, sometimes people might have like a bad relationship contract or an unrealistic contract.
Or no contract. I mean, does everybody really address this before they take up a long-term relationship?
And sometimes the reason infidelity happened is because there was never a contract in the first place, because people are impulsive and not taking the time to do this. And for me, when I say infidelity is a breach of contract, it's a conscious breach of contract, right? Meaning that I'm aware there's a contract and I violated that, versus the boundaries were not clear, right? Because there are a lot of times where people, it may seem infidelity, but when there is no contract, when there was no clarity about expectation of exclusivity, does that really count, right? Now, you can ask, was it implicit? Did you know that this is what implicit, even though it was spoken about? If it was implicit, then sure, it counts, because at least I had some awareness of it. But if I had zero awareness of it, right? Like, how do you know you're crossing a line when you know there was no line in the first place? So there's also different layers of this. Was it implicit or explicit?
So I think this is really good advice, by the way, for people who are dating and considering getting married. So the millennials are very thoughtful about engaging in long-term contracts. And then we have the Gen Zers after them. And I think these two groups of people are looking at marriage and long-term relationships differently than people older than them. Do you see that?
That is an accurate observation. And I think, again, it's a direction that we need to move toward. And I actually, that couples who are either in open marriage or polyamorous, they tend to also be better in that department of having to be clear about their contract. And I think simply because they cannot afford not to because of the complexity of those models of relationship. But I think whatever relationship model that you identify with, clarity is key. And a lot of, again, a lot of times people shy away from it because, well, that just sounds silly. It just sounds, some people don't even like the concept of a contract. And I say, well, contract, that does not mean obligation in that sense. You're willingly entering that contract. And it's a contract that needs to be adapted. And at some point in time, it could end and terminate if people are no longer able to be doing their parts or parts of the contract was not working for them. So that does not mean it's set in stone. It just means it's at least setting the stage for clarity.
And in my era and people around my age, which I won't expose at this moment, what we did talk about was simply, do we want to have children or not? And if we want to have children, do we want to have two working parents? Or the most traditional model of one parent works and the other parent stays at home. I don't think this is an unsexy concept because whether you know it or not, you are entering a contract. And when you go to get divorced, and I explain this to everybody, I know this is one of the most emotional experiences of your life, but the state looks at it as an economic issue. We are financially separating two people's lives. It's all about money and economics, and it will come to that. So you're entering a contract whether you like it or not by virtue of the fact that you have to go to City Hall to get a marriage license. It is all framed and rooted in paperwork.
I'm glad you brought this because, again, to me, that's the crazy part about this whole thing because not only what you outline, this is just like a clear indicator of a contract, but even the ritual part, right? You know, you have witnesses, you have weddings, you're, you know, in front of somebody who is representing whatever faith you belong to. I mean, even the ritual and the optics of it, everything screams contract. It doesn't make any sense to enter that with all these optics, but it really without doing the basic work to get there.
A prenuptial agreement. How unsexy is that, right? But there's a lot of them, especially in Beverly Hills where I work. Okay, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no worries. So then, you know, we could spend hours talking about getting the stories. And one thing to keep in mind in getting the story, this is something that oftentimes cannot be done in one session. And I always tell my clients is that, you know, I don't care how many sessions we spend on getting the story, we do it until it's right. We do it to the point where the story makes sense to everybody's satisfaction because we don't have access to 24/7 audio and video surveillances of what happened. We might have some evidence. We might have some text, pictures, maybe some audio recordings, right? But even these things that you have, they don't reflect anything. They don't reflect the whole picture. They don't tell you about the thoughts and feelings and motivation. So I would say, you know, let's give the unfaithful the opportunity to tell the story. Allow me as a clinician to ask guiding questions. And as a betrayed, you're more than welcome to ask any question that you want about the story. But before we deem this an appropriate level of disclosure, we have to determine what. How is the answer to this question that you're asking is going to help us understand what happened or why. If you can make a case for it, then it's a good question to ask. If not, then it's probably unnecessary detail that we don't really need to share, right? And sometimes people, the need driving the question is healthy. It's just they're struggling to figure out what's the right question to ask. So it gives you an opportunity as a clinician to help them ask the right question so they can get the pieces that they need to move on.
Perfect.
So then the next step is really to, the third milestone is acknowledging the impact. Also, most importantly, when we complete the getting the story milestone, we have to make the conscious commitment as the unfaithful, the betrayed, and the clinician, that we're not going to reopen that part about the story. That doesn't mean that we're done talking about our feelings and processing the trauma. Is that we're giving ourselves a break from interrogation. We're giving ourselves a break from reading, rereading those texts and analyzing them. Because again, people sometimes can get stuck ruminating on these issues, because if you wrap your mind about what happened, now it's time to move forward to the other steps. The third milestone is acknowledging the impact of infidelity, and acknowledging the impact is an opportunity for the unfaithful, as well as the betrayed, to understand that, you know, infidelity is not just damaging for the betrayed, it's also impactful for the unfaithful. But most importantly, this is an opportunity for unfaithful to really to pause and look at the damage that this was caused. I'm a big believer in that there is a healing power in shame and guilt. That doesn't mean that I want to beat somebody up with their shame and guilt, but I think we all have those emotions for a reason. We should not block ourselves from experiencing the natural consequences of our behavior. It is important for the unfaithful to connect with some of those unpleasant feelings that he or she may have about what they did. And it's important for the betrayed to witness them showcasing those emotions. Because if I'm the betrayed and entertaining rebuilding the relationship with my partner, I need to know that he or she know how what they did damaged me, right? It's not just simply, I'm sorry I cheated, I'm sorry that you found out. I need you to know, can you understand and articulate your understanding of this damage? Do you understand that because of your infidelity, now I don't like how I look in the mirror? Because of your infidelity, now I'm having to feel insecure and check messages and check comments where I never had to do this before. Do you know that because of your infidelity, I'm having to worry about STI or worried about somebody, you know, third party coming in? You know, because of your infidelity, I'm isolated because I can't tell anybody about what's going on because I don't want to, put our business to everybody else to hear. Or do you know, because of your infidelity, now, you know, my friends who know about this, they're going to see me as a doormat or so on and so forth. So prior to people coming to counseling, a lot of times unfaithful have made a bazillion apologies, but none of these things were accepting or meaningful because they were reactionary. But when the unfaithful actually give an apology after articulating the scope and extent of the damage that they caused, it's amazing how much more value that apology have, because if they say, okay, I get it. I truly see that you understand this, because if I see that, maybe you're less likely to do this in the future again, because you're not a monster, right? You're capable of seeing cause and effect and actually showcasing the right emotions behind it.
And then trust can start to develop again.
Well, this is one of the first steps in which both of them are joining together without them actually making a decision about the future of the relationship. Because on the flip side of that is what, you know, this would be during this milestone. I also asked the betrayed, how do you think the infidelity impacted the unfaithful, right? And oftentimes they say, you know.
Who cares?
Well, yeah, there's that part of who cares, right? But also sometimes pay attention to how are they interacting with you right now, right? And this is an opportunity to correct a misperception. So a common thing that you'll say, well, how do you think they're impacting you? Well, I don't know. I feel like, you know, they don't want to talk about what's going on. I feel they're apathetic. Why do you think they're apathetic? Well, because every time I try to talk to them about that infidelity, right, they don't want to talk about it. They try to change the subject. And when you ask the unfaithful, does this happen? They said, yeah, they're right about their observation, but they're wrong about why this happens. I said, okay, well, tell me why. He said, well, yeah, I don't want to talk about it because I'm so guilty. I'm so ashamed of what I did. I can't even look at myself in the mirror. And all of a sudden you have a light bulb moment on the betrayal. It's like, wow, yeah, it's nice that you're suffering because I'm not the only who's suffering, but I really didn't know that. Here I am misinterpreting your behavior. Not only that you were unfaithful, but now you're apathetic. So it changes the picture of how they're interacting with another. And also, it allows them to begin to be vulnerable during a very difficult time. Now, whether or not the betrayed is going to say, well, I'm going to feel sorry for you and be there for your need or not, it varies. Some people actually have the capacity beyond their pain to be there for their partner. Some, no, you know, but at least I know, yeah, I'm not going to help you with your pain. I'm glad to hear that I'm not alone in my pain, but at least I know that we are sharing this trauma together.
Excellent. Fourth milestone?
Choosing a path. So remember we said the purpose of infidelity counseling is to figure out where to go from here. And I always give the analogy of a path because, you know, just because we choose a path, it doesn't mean that we're stuck to it. It just means that we have to take a step in which path that we seems to be the most probable path for success. Now, sometimes before people even entertain choosing a path, they have obstacles. They can even begin to entertain which path to explore. And the obstacles are going to be different for each couple based on their life circumstances and the type of affair, but common ones. While I can't even choose a path because I'm worried about what people don't think. Sometimes I'm worried about choosing a path is what if it's the wrong path? So before you even choose a path, you have to identify from your clients what are those obstacles and do we have concrete ways to overcome those obstacles? But aside from identifying the obstacles that get in the way of choosing which path to choose, how do we make this decision? I don't have a crystal ball to say which one is going to be the best path for you, but that doesn't mean we roll the dice and just blindly choose. So there's three areas, three facets that I have found helpful and valuable that will help couples identify which one is the better path for them. So the first one is the relationship history prior to infidelity. There is two categories of couples who come to couple counseling or two categories of couples who come to infidelity counseling. There is the one who had it and lost it, and there is the one who never had it in the first place.
Had what? I'm sorry.
The one who had it and lost it, and the one who never had it in the first place. The one who never had it in the first place, these are the people who started their relationship on the wrong foot. Their relationship was bad all the way through, and infidelity is just icing on the cake. This was like, you know, the one last installment of a bad relationship. The couple who had and lost it, you know, these are the couple who started a relationship on a healthy path. It was a point they recall in which their relationship was healthy and satisfactory for everybody, but life got in the way and now they're finding themselves in a situation where dealing with infidelity. The one who never had in the first place may not be the best candidates for rebuilding their relationship because they don't have that muscle memory. They don't have that investment, right? What's in it for me to work in a relationship that was from day one? It does not exclude them. It just means that it makes it less likely to be a path of success because the relationship was from the beginning, right?
Right, and it allows them the opportunity to resolve something that needs to be resolved, I guess.
Sure, and it's really, you know, identifying, you know, why did we even start the relationship and didn't really have to get to this point before we separate. And that's why I'm saying that even if the end conclusion that we separate, at least now we're separating and we get closure of why we're separating rather than being stuck on this dysfunctional relationship.
Right. And then each person can use that as a springboard for a new relationship. Let me not make this mistake again, choosing somebody that isn't nurturing, fulfilling, and the right person for me.
Correct. Okay. Well, like I said, you know, being in that category in itself does not disqualify just one thing, you know, one thing to consider in terms of a predictor to which one a better path. The other area of assessment that I look at is how do people do in the previous milestones of recovery that we have discussed? How do they do in honoring the agreements that we made and setting the stage for healing, right? By not reaching out to the third party and causing problems. How do they do in getting the story? Is the unfaithful is actually transparent? Is that the unfaithful is open and honest about what happened? Or is he or she are shying away from uncovering those truths and being deceptive and lying throughout the whole process? How are they doing in acknowledging the impact? Do they truly get the damage what they did? Do they get that damage in showcasing the right emotions? If they're failing in those previous milestones, then they're probably not going to be good candidates for rebuilding because they couldn't even do the basic fundamental building blocks for rebuilding a relationship. The third area of assessment is the type of the affair as well as the actual causes of the affair. And for this one, there is no right or wrong answer. It's going to be different for each couple and each individual. Based on their life experiences and worldviews. For some, sexual affairs are forgivable, emotionals are not. For others, it's the other way around. But when we also look at the causes of infidelity, some people might be willing to rebuild their relationship if the cause was relationship factors. They might say, you know what, if it's a relationship factor, I can wrap my mind around this, I have a part to play in this, I have some control over the outcome, so I'm willing to rebuild. Others might say, no, relationship factors, you don't like me, it's personal, right? And you can make the same argument for individual factors. And that gives us back to why the story of the infidelity happened, because if you don't have that data, you're not going to be able to make that decision. So the outcome of those three areas of assessment is what helped guys be able to figure out which one is the better path for them to rebuild together or heal separately.
And then your fifth milestone, creating a plan of action. This is where, whether you stay or separate, if you have to co-parent, this is a really important step, right? To support the co-parenting?
That is correct. So let's talk a little bit about the plan of action. So the plan of action here can be a plan of action for separation or a plan of action for rebuilding. So the plan of action for separation, the short-term and long-term goals have to be related to how do we separate in an amicable way that would allow us to function in a healthy way post that separation. Now, I always tell this to my couples, and maybe it's not a popular notion, is that what if you don't have a reason to be in each other's life, meaning you don't have mutual assets, you don't have kids, you don't have dogs or cats that you co-parent together, right?
Right.
You don't really need to be in each other's life, right? Because it would be too painful for people to, you know, and a lot of people say, well, why can't we be friends? Well, you couldn't make it as partners. What makes you think that you can be as friends? Because the problem with that is what? The same skill set that's needed for a successful friendship is the same one, well, some of it is needed to have a healthy partnership. And when people make that mistake, what they do is what? They blur the boundaries. You know, they cannot just stay friends and causes complication because one of them is going to move on and the other one is waiting, right? And create problems for a future relationship that they have. But the one who don't have the luxury of not being in each other's life, it is important to talk about, you know, how are we going to redefine the roles that we're going to be playing in each other's life? So for co-parents, we need to have a clear idea of what that means and keep it within those parameters. Co-parenting doesn't mean that I would go, you know, occasionally and, you know, have a one-night stand with you because we're co-parent. For co-parents, our co-parenting is what is related to the well-being of our kids, the communication about that. We should operate within those parameters and not play anything other role outside of that because it's too painful, it's too confusing, and prevents people from moving forward. But whether we're talking about a plan of separation or plan of action, it is important for people to clarify why are we choosing this, right? Because both paths, whether it's rebuilding the relationship or healing separately, are going to be very difficult. And in order for people to stay the course, regarding which direction, they have to have true, healthy motives for choosing that path. So what would be a bad motive to rebuild together? Well, it would be because, we should rebuild because of the sake of the kids or because divorce is too expensive. That's not a good reason for rebuilding together. That can be a bonus reason, but cannot be the primary reason. It has to be is because I believe this person that I'm entertaining rebuilding a relationship with have the capacity of meeting my needs and I have the capacity of meeting theirs. What would be a bad reason to choose to separate? Well, I'm choosing to separate because I don't want people to think wrongly of me or judge me because how can I stay in a relationship after infidelity? That's not a good reason. You have to live your life for yourself rather than what other people think, right? Because those people have their own life. They're just judging you from the sidelines. So that's why it's important, again, when we're talking about whether plan of action to separate or rebuild is to have the clear motives and then, you know, guiding the process. But more specifically, when we're talking about the separation, before we even talk about the co-parenting piece, it is important to have closure. If we're choosing to end this relationship, why is it ending? Again, this is not an opportunity to blame each other, to say your fault. This is an opportunity to say, okay, this is the part that I have contributed. This is the part that you have contributed. And this is why it cannot work. And the goal of this, again, not to blame each other, is really just to have that clarity and ownership so that you can use that clarity and ownership to not have bad relationship post-separation, because we have to imagine, you know, a life post-separation and you don't want to repeat those mistakes in the future.
If I could add just a little something from my end, since it really does come up in mediation, my personal philosophy to make sense of this world and to make sense of damage that can happen to us in this world, the purpose of, and to answer the purpose of life, which of course I questioned since I was out of the womb, and that is everything makes sense to me if I look at all of life as a learning lesson. And our lessons come in so many sizes and so many outfits and so many experiences that if we just stop for a second and say, what am I supposed to learn from this to add value to my life? All of a sudden, you've taken a very positive step. You framed this in a much healthier way to benefit personally and to get rid of all of the anger and the stuff inside of us that damages our health.
Yeah, I agree full-heartedly. I would say not only that sense of the trauma and fidelity is a very hard and valuable lesson, but also there is a sense of, you know, being at peace of what happened. That doesn't mean I justify it or excuse it or make it okay. It's just, you know what? This is what happened. This is why it happened. How can I move forward? Right?
If it happens again, well.
Sure. Different stuff.
I can see that would be very, very hurtful, but yeah, everything is a learning lesson. And people like you can help us learn the best, worst thing that can happen from infidelity.
And I feel like I owe your audience is explaining that controversial statement and title for the book. But before I even do that part, because, you know, we're talking about the plan of action for separating, the plan of action for rebuilding a relationship, the Cliff Note version of that is what? The short-term and long-term goals in that plan is going to be, the short-term goals would be related to how do we rebuild trust and earn forgiveness, but also the long-term goals would be addressing the relationship, the individual issues, as well as the sociocultural factors that have led to infidelity. And again, you know, any plan in order for it to be successful, whether it's for separation or rebuilding, has to be concrete, specific, and adaptable. That give us the summary of the fifth milestone, which is creating a plan of action. The sixth milestone is implementation and healing pain. And at this point in time, we're talking about, what happens once we implement this action, that plan of action for separation. It's going to be difficult, even if it's the right thing to do. People are going to struggle, right? They don't want to lose their investment, their relationship, despite the pain and hurt. They still love their partner. So this is the time where people need to surround themselves with a good support system, seeking the right intervention to help them make this transition, but also for the couples who are rebuilding their relationship. Now it's the time to understand that just because we have a plan of action, we have a decision to repair the relationship, it's not going to be easy. They're going to be triggers. Infidelity causes PTSD. If you look at the symptoms of the diagnosis in the DSM-5 about PTSD and just change the word traumatic event to infidelity, it's going to be picture perfect. So people need to know, and this is specifically for the unfaithful, they need to know that the betrayed is going to struggle. They're going to have triggers. And just because they have any triggers does not mean they're getting better. It just means that this is part of the healing process. And how we handle those triggers is going to determine the overall length of the recovery. And lastly, the seventh milestone is sustainability. And this piece goes to, and now we're talking about the couples who are rebuilding their relationship. If everybody does their part right, couples are going to be able to achieve a new level of relationship that has never been attained before. And it sounds crazy. Like, how could something good come out of the infidelity? But this brings me back full circle to explain why infidelity is the best worst thing that could happen. So why infidelity is the worst thing that could happen, that's easy to explain. But, you know, but I need to highlight why is it worse from my standpoint. It's worse because the worst thing that can happen to a marriage, one, because it destroys trust, which is the most important component of a healthy relationship. It's hard to retain, it's hard to repair once you lose it. And two, it affects our sense of adequacy because, you know, when you are engaged in an affair, you unfairly drag your partner that betrayed to comparison with a third party, even if they're not in the same league. Right? So it challenges our sense of adequacy. So from my vantage point, that's why it's the worst thing. Why is it the best thing? Well, this is a little bit more tricky to answer. So I believe the trauma of infidelity give couples two rare elements that I wish we had in traditional couples counseling. One is system shock, and two is nothing to lose attitude.
Say the second thing again.
Nothing to lose attitude.
Okay.
So the system shock is what? If you think about it, in our personal life, if we're talking about just medical ailments, when we have any kind of pains and aches, we don't automatically jump and see our doctor. We have to wait for something usually significant and serious before we seek intervention, right? When we're talking about just medical issues. People do the same thing with mental health issues, whether it's individual or relationship issues, right? They don't deal with those individual relationship problems until it becomes significant enough to warrant help. Not only that, but oftentimes they don't do preventative measures yet. I mean, we go to the dentist for cleaning, but you don't go for a therapist for, you know, maintenance, right?
Right.
So if you follow that example, infidelity is that serious wake-up call. Right? This is the system shock that forces people out of this autopilot. It's a rude wake-up call that forces couples to no longer ignore the individual and relationship issues that they've been dealing with. So it's kind of like a heart attack. It forces them to actually act on those individual and relationship issues, right? Which means that they're going to actually come in and deal with that individual relationship issue that should have been dealt with a long time ago. The nothing to lose attitude is that, you know, infidelity is like, this is the worst thing that could happen in a relationship. So at this point in time, whether you're the betrayed, whether you're unfaithful, if you really want to save your relationship, you're going to be compelled to lay all the cards on the table, because really, at this point in time, the cat is out of the bag and the damage is already there. You're either going to repair it or not repair it. So it gives you that element of laying all the cards on the table, which allows the couples to really be successful in addressing all those issues, the ones that are related to infidelity and the ones that may be not related to infidelity. So if you put that back together to the sustainability milestone is, you know, if everybody does their part right, now they're going to address all these relationship issues and they're going to have a healthy new relationship, healthier than ever was before, because they address all the stuff that should have been addressed before, which means that you need to help them protect this new baseline of healthy interaction that they have earned after going through these milestones. And that's what the sustainability piece is to help them make sure that they have early warning signs, make sure that they're following through with the action plans, help them to teach them to have regular check-ins so that when they have small problems, they address them right away rather than wait for something bad to happen to seek treatment. So that's in a nutshell describe the 7 milestones of recovery.
I feel better listening to all of that. I mean, again, I work in the field of divorce, so I'm watching relationships break up on a daily basis. But just to know that there is movement forward when trust is broken, to either co-parent well, because you have to stay in each other's lives for that reason, or regardless of children, as you said earlier, and you want to continue the relationship, that insecurity that circles around the issue of trust is just so important to deal with. And I'll just give you a little example of how I really looked at trust. So my life before the divorce business was the entertainment industry. And when I came to Los Angeles, I produced live entertainment for the private event business. One of the big areas of business was weddings, Beverly Hills weddings, tons of money in those weddings for music. And I love weddings. I cry at everybody's wedding. So I made sure as a producer that I would always show up for the ceremonies and become emotional and isn't this great? But the one thing that struck me when people were doing their vows, and this goes back to the contract that you mentioned that you establish at the onset of the relationship. So I listened to all the vows and everything seemed unbelievably unrealistic because I had already been through my own marriage and divorce. We are friends. We had no children. There was no blame on my end and there was infidelity. But I always just looked at it as a symptom of the relationship that we both needed to deal with. And I think, thank God, it was the saddest year of my life because I had to process my own emotions. But when I was standing at those weddings, I said, well, here's how I think the vows should really go. I trust that you are going to hurt me. I trust that you may do things that I am completely shocked about. But please trust me, and I want to trust myself that I will talk to you about it, that I will look at this as an example of something to work on, because no relationship is perfect. So I kind of wanted to see those vows. Of course, nobody did it. What do you think about that?
I love the way that you describe it, because to me, you know, the contract's not only about the clarity, but also about realistic application of that contract, which require flexibility and the ability to adapt, right? It doesn't matter how great we are in identifying our needs and how great of a communicator we are. You could do all this research, do all these self-help books to try to do everything right. We all make mistakes, right? And, you know, we are going to hurt our partners, whether intentionally, unintentionally, or a combination of both, is to be able to, how do we handle these issues when they are small? And we actually walk away with a learning experience where we've changed that versus that I'm sorry and I hurt you. Yes, you know, entering the premise that I'm not perfect, you're not perfect, but guess what? We can be imperfect together and we can both grow together as long as we're open, vulnerable, and transparent. If you have that, you really have a successful recipe for having that happily ever after. Because, you know, there is no guarantee. Just because somebody lived happily with no problems for 20 years doesn't mean the next 20 years is going to be like that. The closest thing for that is being able to what? To realize that you always have to be paying attention to your own needs and your partner needs. You always have to communicate about these things and continue to adapt the relationship contract to the point where it's satisfactory for the two of you. If you achieve that, that is the closest recipe that you can have for that happily ever after, is awareness, clarity, and adaptation.
You know, so beautifully said, because if we look at your comparison in a business contract, the best relationships are where people check in with one another. The partners go out. How did this year go for you? What can we do together to make this better? And that's normal in business. It's not normal in a marriage, but I think it has to be. You've now convinced me.
Well, like I said, you know, it's funny that you said this, because, you know, in that implementation as well as sustainability piece, part of what I asked my client is that introduce them to the concept of regular check-ins and a business meeting for the relationship. I say a minimum once a week. And this should not be confused with date night, right? Business meeting is different than date night. This is the time where you don't have any distraction, right? For the two of you to not only to talk about the things that are not working, this is an opportunity to say, these are the things that are working. These are the things that I appreciate about you. These are the things that happened that I'm concerned about, that rubbed me the wrong way. Let's talk about them and resolve them before they become big issues. Because that's really what you need in a partnership, right? They're going to be, you know, we all need that positive reinforcement of the good things that we're doing. We also need to talk about areas of improvement in peacetime rather than wartime, right? Because if you have that in your regular check-in,
right?
Yeah, you're going to be a better speaker and a better listener rather than have to talk about it when somebody upset you and made you angry.
So well said. Talal, we have come to the end of our hour, and I have to tell you, these two episodes with you have been so enjoyable. I'm very happy that I met you. And I met Talal, if I may share, I belong to a group called Los Angeles Marriage and Family Therapists. Because I network with these people along with networking with lawyers, and you were a speaker a few months ago. I enjoyed that so much that I called you and bought your book, read it, loved it, and thought, boy, does the audience for Constructive Uncoupling need your information and need to know you. So in order to benefit from you beyond buying the book, Infidelity, which I will post for you when we post the episodes, how do they get in touch with you?
So two ways. I have two websites. The first one is infidelitycounselingcenter.com, and the other one is talalalsaleem.com, which I'm sure you will help out with the spelling of my name, Judy.
Absolutely. And you're in Sacramento, but who cares, because COVID, God forbid, has allowed us now to, even more than before, do business with people, access people's services, beyond our immediate geographic area. And we're experts on Zoom, aren't we, Talal?
We are. And thank you so much for having me on the show. I really enjoyed hearing your wisdom and enriching my skill set. And I'm always glad to share my knowledge about infidelity. That's something that's my life work. So I'm always ready to help.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You have been listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces, and Dr. Talal Al-Saleem. I am Judy Weigel, your host. You can reach me through my email address, Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com, Judy at constructiveuncoupling.com, or through my website, divorceresourceinc.com. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and I look forward to speaking with you next week. Take care, and always have an amicable day.